This is Our American Stories. And today, for an hour, we're going to celebrate the life of Elie Wiesel. And he passed recently, and not nearly enough time was spent on this man's life. The news cycle is an awful thing, because this was a truly heroic figure and one of the great writers of our age. And as always, these kinds of segments are brought to us by Hillsdale College. Anytime there's a teaching moment, a moment and a look back in history, and a great writing or historical figures, it's Hillsdale that is sponsoring that work. And he passed on July 2nd at the age of 87. Who was he, in case you don't know? Well, he was a Nobel Peace Prize winner, but that shouldn't move you. He was a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the author of 57 books. He has been called the messenger to humanity, and he was a survivor of the Holocaust, and of Auschwitz in particular, chronicled that survival in the book Night. But there's so much more to this man and his life, and so we wanted to bring it to you. And we like to start things off always at the beginning. He was born on September 30th, 1928, into a very traditional Jewish family.
I grew up, as some of you may know, in a small city somewhere in the Carpathian Mountains, a city, a small village, big village of the smaller city, that somehow all the empires of the world wanted, I don't know why. When my father was born, it was part of Austro-Hungary. When I was born, it was Romania. When I left it, it was Hungary. Now it's Romania again. The problems that we faced, I remember very vividly, was at one point when the Hungarians came in, we had to learn the new anthem overnight in Hungarian. So until then, we sang the anthem in Romanian, like Long Live the King or something, and then it went right away to Hungary. So, nevertheless, my anchor was school, Jewish school, Jewish studies. I come from a very religious background, very religious family. And my father, my grandfather, my mother, we all belong to Hasidic groups. And my joy, all my interests really, were in studies. Nevertheless, I had to go to secular school too. So what we did, we bribed the principal, so I could go to school only a month before the exams. And in that month, I learned everything by heart, passed the exam, forgot quickly everything. What do I need to know about geography, really? What I wanted to know was what happened in the temple 2,000 years ago. That was my interest, the conversations, the dialogues, the beautiful stories of the Talmud. That was my passion, not mathematics or physics, who cares? I didn't anyway.
Elie Wiesel described to Oprah Winfrey in a magnificent special that she produced how and when the Nazis came and why his family just didn't flee.
We didn't know. We thought that when the deportation will come, it will mean simply that we will be taken inside Hungary. No one in the world has told us, has warned us, that there is a place called Auschwitz. When we arrived in Auschwitz, May 1944, 3 weeks before D-Day, we didn't know what it meant. If I am angry at times, profoundly angry, it is because we could have been saved. The largest community still alive in Europe, the Hungarian Jewish community, could have been saved. If not in its totality, at least in its great part, because the Russians were 20 kilometers away from us. And we saw at night the artillery exchange. Mm-hmm. We saw the fire. We were surrounded by mountains. There were maybe 2 Germans in our city, maybe 50 Hungarian soldiers, gendarmes, guarding the ghetto. There were Christian women and men who offered hospitality to us. We had a servant, marvelous woman called Maria, and she had a hut in the mountains. And she sneaked into the ghetto, and she pleaded with us. Come, she said, come and stay with us. We could have gone and stayed with her and survived. But we didn't know.
And when you say we, you mean your father?
I mean the entire city.
Yeah.
There were 15,000 Jews in that city. And we did.
But Maria came specifically to your family and said, come look.
Correct. But there were other Marias who went to other places. We know about them. Mm-hmm.
So what did you think when you were taken from Sziget? What did you think was going to happen the night that you, first you lived in the ghettos and they turned the community into a ghetto, and then people were really marched out of the town. Where did you think you were going?
That we would go inside Hungary into a labor camp and wait for the end of the war. Mm-hmm. We were told that that would happen, and we believed it.
And by the way, why not believe it at the time or before? And this is what happened in war. People went to labor camps, then they came out. And it's shocking to hear now that there were people warning them, and they didn't listen. But they didn't know. I mean, obviously, if they did, they would have run. And they would have hid. When we come back, we're going to hear more from that remarkable piece that Oprah produced. We're going to hear from Elie Wiesel and Elie Wiesel in his own words. We're going to hear some very famous and not so famous people talking about how Wiesel influenced their lives. This is a figure you should know if you don't. And if you do, you're going to truly enjoy this hour, particularly Elie Wiesel's visit to Disneyland. He wrote about it. He actually got to interview Walt Disney. And Disney was a real hero of Elie's. And you're going to find out why. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories. This is Our American Stories, and we're continuing to celebrate and commemorate the life of Elie Wiesel. And by the way, he's the founding chairman of the Holocaust Memorial Museum. He was once posed the question about whether the museum could answer tough questions like, how could murderers do what they did and go on living? And here is Wiesel's answer. Oh, I don't believe there are answers. There are no answers. And this museum is not an answer. It is a question mark. If there is a response, it is a response in responsibility. Let's get back to that interview with Oprah Winfrey, or that special, more accurately, with Oprah. Here is Elie Wiesel speaking to Oprah about the concentration camps and remembering the last time he saw his youngest sister.
I think the souls are here. I think that they listen, they cry, they warn. Look, this is the largest cemetery in recorded history. And what do you see? Nothing.
Nothing.
But the cemetery is in our heart. You know, I have in my pocket the picture of my little sister, which I've never spoken about, not even with you. But the only time I cry is not when I speak about my parents, but I speak about my little sister. Mm-hmm. There, she makes me cry.
How old was
seven.
She? Seven. She was seven. She was seven when you went to the camp. I know. I remember walking the grounds with you and us standing there, the two of us standing there and looking at the way your sister had gone. Where were you separated from your little sister and your mother?
There. And my sisters, with the two older sisters, my grandmother. And my little sister, I remember her because she had a a red coat that she got for holiday.
A little red coat?
Yeah. And that's when I saw them. I saw them disappear all of a sudden. They went left, they went right. Yes. They went to a crematorium. Mm-hmm. That was a crematorium.
Why do you think it is, speaking of her, that still brings the tears? Because of a life unfulfilled, unlived? Why
the children, my God, why the children? You know, that a million and a half children were killed. Then, like that, straight from the train. Do you know what they have done to humanity? How many among them could have grown up to become scientists, mm-hmm. physicians, poets, scholars, friends of humanity, saviors of the world? What they have done to the world.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, they were at Auschwitz filming this and the desolate nature of that place. And it was in the dead of winter that they did it too. And it was a gray day. And the expanse of it, it's just incomprehensible. And Oprah continues with Elie Wiesel. How does this type of mass genocide occur?
So you saw children being thrown into the flames alive?
For a while I thought maybe I was still the prisoner of my nightmare. Mm-hmm. But then I met friends, and they too remember the same images. I found documents corroborating that what we have seen was true.
And that was the first night?
The first night. At which time I turned to my father at one point, I said, I'm afraid to die in flames. I had ideas, images from history books, the Inquisition, when Jews were put to death because of their belief. Mm-hmm. And they were burned like witches here on the stake. And I was afraid of that. I said, maybe I should run to the electrified gates and die. Mm-hmm. But even that was part of the nightmare.
The possibility of going to...
Everything, the whole way. I should speak to my father like that, mm-hmm. about that. And then I said to my father, it's not true. I don't think it's true. I don't think that this is possible. I cannot believe that all this...
Even
there,
though you'd seen it,
in the shadow of flames, I said to him, I cannot believe that this is true. I cannot believe that this could happen in the heart of Europe, of civilized Europe, the middle of the 20th century, and the world would be silent. That was the one thing that bothered me, that more than anything else later on, is the silence of the world.
Yes, and you say that hatred is not the opposite of love. Indifference is.
The indifference. That's why, you know, we created a foundation, my wife and I, later on with my Nobel money, with some friends. And the reason was to fight indifference. And we have seminars all over the world, Anatomy of Hate. We tried mm-hmm. to understand the genesis of hate, the texture of hate, the fabric of hate. Hate, in a way, we know how to fight it. Indifference. How can you fight indifference?
Indeed. And it wasn't just his family that was affected by Nazis, obviously. Let's listen as he described to Oprah what else was lost.
Imagine 4 million people lived and vanished overnight in this place. A whole nation could be built with 4 million people. There could be enough doctors, enough teachers, enough parents, enough children, enough princes, enough kings, enough merchants, enough dreamers, enough teachers to build a people. And in this space, which became the grave of man's heart, that kingdom vanished forever. I swear to you, I didn't know that I would survive. I was convinced that I will never leave Auschwitz. I want to remember everything. Every word and every tear.
Well, nobody did more to further the remembrance of the Holocaust than Wiesel with his book Night. In 1986, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for being a messenger to mankind. and grappling with his own personal experience of total humiliation and of the utter contempt for humanity shown in Hitler's death camps, as well as his practical work in the cause of peace. And his speech was something, and we wanted to bring just pieces of it to you. If he couldn't speak for the dead, the question was, what could he do?
I remember. It happened yesterday, or eternities ago. A young Jewish boy discovered the kingdom of night. I remember his bewilderment. I remember his anguish. It all happened so fast. The ghetto, the decrees, the persecutions, the deportation, the sealed cattle car, the fiery altar upon which the history of my people and the future of mankind were meant to be sacrificed. I remember that young boy asked his father, "Tell me," he said, "can this be true? This is the 20th century after all. This is not the Middle Ages. Who would allow such crimes to be committed? And how could the world remain silent?" And now that very boy is turning to me. "Tell me," he says, "what have you done with my years? What have you done with your life, which is mine?" And then I tell him that I have tried to keep memory alive, that I have tried to fight those who forget, because as you have said, if we forget, we are guilty, we are accomplices, we could not prevent their death the first time. But if we forget them, they will be killed the second time, and this time it will be our responsibility.
And when we come back, a couple of more clips from that Nobel speech. It's remarkable. And we're going to hear Elie Wiesel on Disneyland. We're going to hear from Alan Dershowitz. We're going to hear from Natan Sharansky and so many more. And most important, again, we're going to hear Elie Wiesel on Disneyland. This is Our American Stories. More on the life of Elie Wiesel after these messages. This is Our American Stories and the life story of Elie Wiesel, commemorated here because, well, no one else really did. I didn't hear our long storytelling on Elie Wiesel. The daily drip of the news just drowned it out, and this man's life deserves at least an hour, maybe more. And so we take you back to that Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, and here he is talking about his Jewish heritage, the state of Israel, and about speaking out and indifference.
"Since I am a Jew profoundly rooted in my people's memory and tradition, my first response is to Jewish fears, Jewish needs, Jewish crises. For I belong to a traumatized generation, one that experienced the abandonment and solitude of my people.
It would be unnatural for me not to make Jewish priorities my own. It would be unnatural for me not to love Israel with all my heart as I do. Please remember what I remember. Israel, if, God forbid, defeated, it would be the end of Israel, the only country in the world which is so endangered, totally in its existence. How can we, people such as myself, not think in these terms? But I am also, of course, committed to Soviet Jews who need freedom, and Jews in Arab lands who need solidarity. But I said that Jewish priorities are my first priorities. They are not exclusive. Believe me that apartheid is, in my view, as abhorrent as anti-Semitism. To me, Andrei Sakharov's isolation is as much of a disgrace as Yosef Biegun's imprisonment and Idan Nudel's exile, as is the denial of solidarity and its leader Lech Walesa's right to dissent, and Nelson Mandela's interminable imprisonment.
In spite of all the suffering, his suffering, Wiesel ended his acceptance speech with hope, with a call for us to be better and to do better.
I have faith in God, in the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. I even have faith in his creation. Without faith, no action would be possible. And action is the only remedy to indifference.
And we want to hear now from some voices who remember Elie Wiesel's life as well. And from the Boston Globe, Alan Dershowitz, the famed law professor from Harvard University, and a guy who's fought for all kinds of freedoms around the world, had this to say. He recorded it for us.
Elie Wiesel was my teacher. He was my rabbi, my mentor, my colleague, and ultimately my dear friend. Over the past 50 years, we worked together on numerous human rights projects. Elie did more to bring the word human into human rights than any person in modern history. For him, it didn't matter whether the victims of genocide were Jews or Christians or Muslims, whether they were black or white, left or right. Human rights were equally applicable to all human beings. Elie was deeply involved in campaigns on behalf of the victims of genocide in Darfur, in Rwanda, in the former Yugoslavia, in Cambodia, and in the Middle East. In fact, my last substantive conversation with him, which of course I'll never forget, it was shortly before his final illness, was about the genocide currently taking place in Syria, where hundreds of thousands of Muslims are being slaughtered by both sides of an intractable conflict. He bemoaned the unwillingness of the international community to stop the slaughter. Have we learned nothing? He asked rhetorically. For Elie Wiesel, the worst sin was silence in the face of evil. The worst crime was indifference to genocide. And the worst people were those who stand idly by the blood of their neighbors. Though he and his family were victims of the Holocaust, he never dwelled on his personal pain, but rather on the pain of those currently being victimized. I first met Elie following the publication of his book, The Jews of Silence, in the late 1960s. That book dealt with the plight of Soviet Jews who were being persecuted in the Soviet Union. He inspired me to go to the Soviet Union to defend those who were being criminally prosecuted for doing nothing more than practicing their religion. We continued to work together on many, many matters involving Jewish victims, non-Jewish victims, victims of every background who were being persecuted around the world. I began as his student. I then became his colleague and finally his dear, dear friend. We shared a worldview and a commitment to repairing a badly damaged planet. He would call me on the phone all the time and complain we weren't doing enough. He always wanted to do more. I called him my Jewish mother because he would nag me. You got to do more. We can't leave it to anyone else to do more. Elie Wiesel was one of the most important people in the post-World War II period. He spoke the truth to power, regardless of who was in power. For example, he loved and he respected President Ronald Reagan, and yet he lectured him about not going to Bitburg to commemorate the Nazi killers who were buried in an SS grave. He spoke up when others were silent. He spoke up for those for whom no one else championed. For that, he justly received the Nobel Peace Prize. I was honored to be among those who nominated him for that prize, which he used as a platform to rail against injustice. He spoke softly, so softly that one had to lean forward to hear his hushed tones. But what he said inspired, stimulated, and produced results. He saved so many lives by his quiet advocacy. He would call world leaders on the phone and persuade them to save the lives of people who are in danger, and he never took credit for his life-saving actions. Among his most enduring contributions will be his great memoir, Night, which has become required reading in so many schools around the world and has influenced so many young people to join the enduring battle against injustice. Elie did so many things in his life. He wrote books, he advocated for justice, he ran a foundation for humanity with his wonderful wife, Marion. But whenever he was asked what his job was, he would reply, "I am a teacher." He loved to teach more than anything else. He loved his students, and his students loved him. He saw the world as a large classroom with his role as one of its teachers. Shortly before his final illness, Elie and I agreed to teach a course together at Boston University. We had scheduled the first preliminary joint lecture, but his illness required postponement, and it was never to be. But even in death, Professor Elie Wiesel will continue to teach generations of students through his passionate writings and by his uncompromising example. I'm going to miss my friend Elie every day of my life. The world will miss Elie Wiesel for as long as the quest for justice continues.
And thank you for that, Alan Dershowitz. And when we come back, more from Elie Wiesel himself and some more remembrances, and as we promised, his writing on visiting Disneyland.
Can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later gotta cut you down, sooner or later gotta cut you down.
And we conclude our hour-long commemoration of Elie Wiesel's life. Alan Dershowitz had just talked about his relationship, and in the end he described this great man as a teacher. And as we celebrate the accomplishments of this man, it's especially amazing how many lives he touched. This was, after all, a man who thought of himself as a lifelong student, too, not just a teacher. Here is a personal story from Isabel Vincent, the New York Post's investigative reporter. She went on to become an award-winning reporter who covered, among many other things, the conflicts that led to the war in Kosovo. As if being a foreign correspondent and investigative reporter weren't enough, she's also written 5 books, including Dinner with Edward, the story of how much cooking lessons from a 93-year-old friend taught her about life. Let's take a listen.
If there was a decisive moment in my life that shaped my future as a writer, it was the day Elie Wiesel shook my hand. I was 17 and had just finished my proudest piece of writing, an English essay from my senior year literature class, which included the phrase, "Man's Inhumanity to Man," in its long, lofty title, the entirety of which I can no longer remember. I was the only non-Jewish student in my Holocaust literature class, and my teacher was so proud of my essay that she decided to take me to meet Wiesel, speaking at a synagogue in Toronto, where I grew up. Unbeknownst to me, Mrs. Soberman had sent him a copy of my essay. It was 1982, and Wiesel was not yet a Nobel laureate. He was a humanities professor at Boston University and lectured widely about the Holocaust. His first and most famous book, Night, the harrowing story of how the Nazis rounded up and shipped his family to Auschwitz, resonated deeply with me. Wiesel's mother and one of his sisters was killed at Auschwitz, and his father died just weeks before the camps were liberated. Emaciated and sick, Wiesel was among the survivors liberated by American soldiers at Buchenwald in April 1945. I'm not sure why Wiesel's book became so important to me, a suburban Catholic kid whose biggest trauma was not getting a date to the prom at Sir Sanford Fleming Secondary School, a public high school that was 95% Jewish. Maybe it was because Wiesel was my age when he lived through the horror at Night. Or maybe it was because it was the first time I recognized what good writing is all about. In Wiesel's case, conveying horror through spare, economical prose, a device that rendered it all the more horrific to me. Never shall I forget that night, the first night in camp, which has turned my life into one long night, seven times cursed and seven times sealed, he writes in Night. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the little faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath a silent blue sky. The phrase was important to me, and I used it in my essay, but it wasn't as important as that handshake. The grip was firm and steadfast and warm as he held my hand in an embrace that seemed to go on and on and on. Never forget about the murder of the 6 million, he said. Document evil wherever you find it. And I can still remember the smiling intensity in his eyes when he fixed me with his steady gaze and said, "I read your essay. Don't ever stop writing."
Don't ever stop writing. What a thing to say. And what a great personal touch. And again, that humanity, always there. And not too long ago, Wiesel sat down with Charlie Rose to discuss one of his memoirs. And he talked about the impact all of this had on his ability to commit, and that is marriage and fear.
For many, many years, I thought I will not get married. Right. And that I will not have children. For many years, I was afraid of having children. I felt I have no right to do that. I have no right to impose my past and make it their future. But then, you know how it is. You met a very special person, and you link your life to hers, and the child comes, and now he is the center of our life.
And so those were the scars, and he had to overcome them and ultimately propelled himself into love. And let's take a listen to more of this discussion.
You found what?
It's hope, naturally. Hope is something that is essential to life. You know, just as the body cannot live without dreams, the soul cannot live without hope. You need hope. And if there is no hope, to paraphrase Albert Camus, you must create it. But it's more than that and something else than that. Meaning, it's meaning. We're looking for meaning. Our life is a quest for meaning. And the meaning is never something that comes from within. It comes from the other, from the person next to you, sitting next to you, looking at you, eating with you, or walking with you. And this is something which we have learned, I think, throughout the years, even in those dark years. Those people, the few of them, who managed somehow to survive is because they had someone to whom they belonged and lived for each other.
And so hope is just such an important part in the end of his life. My team dug up something that I just had to share with you. and I had promised I would, and it's Elie Wiesel's visit to Disneyland. Turns out he suffered from a cab accident in New York City, and he was hurt pretty badly. And so he took some time and just went across country from New York to Los Angeles. And in this piece of writing that he did for a Jewish publication that he wrote in Hebrew, he had this to say first about America, because to get to Disneyland, he had to see the country that he didn't really know until this trip. Here's what he wrote. We went to concerts, restaurants. By now I was walking with a cane, which I thought made me look distinguished, but I tired easily. We rented a car, and we took this six-week cross-country trip from New York to Los Angeles. We discovered an America unknown to us, totally different from New York or Washington, which were the only places I knew. Interminable highways disappeared into a blue horizon, ringing tall mountains embedded in skies of shifting colors. There were cascading rivers, peaceful brooks, green valleys and yellow hills, violent storms, and dramatic sunsets. Never before had I been so close to nature. From the hills of San Francisco, we gazed upon small towns floating in the fog as in a dream. In the Rocky Mountains, the clouds seemed to wear a crown of snow. To touch it, you would have to climb to God's throne. Enchanting mirages. They are so disconcerting, you cannot tell which is close and which is far, which is real and which is not. You have a sense of being present at a recreation of the world. And then finally, to Disney World. And here's what he writes. I don't know if a Garden of Eden awaits adults in the hereafter. I do know, though, that there is a Garden of Eden for children here in this life. I know because I myself visited this paradise. I have just returned from there. And again, this is 1957. I have passed through its gates, just left the magical kingdom known as Disneyland. And as I bid that kingdom farewell, I understood for the first time the true meaning of the French saying, to leave is to die a little. And then he describes the place, and he's just overcome by the size and the scale. A kingdom all of whose citizens are happy. A kingdom that relates not only to man, but to animals as well, and humanely. For instance, any horse that works in Disneyland may not work more than 4 hours a day or more than 6 days a week. In many, many countries, people would die for such working conditions. Several times in that article, Wiesel reflects on his appreciation of Walt Disney. The person who created this land, this universe, must be a genius, a rare genius. And then he shared the anecdote that he was told of how Walt Disney often walks around Disneyland in disguise. Wiesel understood why. Quote, if one wants to calm his nerves and forget the bitter realities of daily life, there is no better suited place to do so than Disneyland. In Disneyland, the land of children's dreams, everything is simple, beautiful, and good. There, no one screams at his fellow. No one is exploited by his fellow. No one's fortune derives from his fellow's misfortune. If children had the right to vote, they would vote Disney their president, and the whole world would look different. What writing. And so, as we close, though he's so often remembered for his writing on the Holocaust, he tried as often as possible not to be remembered, not to be in that, as he called it, a niche writer. And so let's hear him talk to Charlie Rose about joy.
Freedom means to be free. And the word tolerance, I used to use it. Now I pre-
the joy of human celebration.
Well, without joy, what would life be, really? First of all, I believe in friendship. Friendship means also joy. A friend is someone not who is with you in distress, but who is with you in joy. Mm. And also, we have young people. I have my son. And young people, they deserve our joy, not our despair. So we try to create joy.
And in his memoirs, the word see is in the title. And we're going to close with Charlie Rose asking why, and here is Elie Wiesel's answer.
Well, the see, this, I know that this, the word comes from the Ecclesiast, but for me, see is memory.
The word comes from Ecclesiastes, And the word for me means memory. And if anything, that's what Elie Wiesel's life was all about. This is Our American Story. For the hour, this remarkable man celebrated, commemorated. This is Our American Story. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to hear any and all of this and great work by the entire team. Habib with Our American Stories, and now it's time for our This Day in History segment brought to us by Hillsdale College. This is the story about one American who's considered the richest man ever to live, yet very few people could tell you why. Well, we're about to give you the answer to that question by telling this man's unbelievable life story.
Just 5 days after the end of the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln is the final of the 600,000 deaths in America's bloodiest conflict. The country is divided, and the world looks at American democracy as a failed experiment. But what most don't realize is that a new era has dawned. The nation is entering an age of advancement. And from the void left by the death of perhaps the greatest statesman we will ever know, a new breed of leader will emerge. Men of insight, innovation, and ingenuity, the likes of which the world has never seen. And over the next 5 decades, this small group will change history, propelling the United States of America to greatness. Here's Donald Trump.
These were great men with a vision that nobody else had. And that's why in the last century, that 50-year period, we built the world.
At this time in the country's short existence, the man most capable of leading America is not a politician. Here's Mark Cuban.
Back then, it was just pure competition. My brain against your brain, my effort against your effort. You just competed. That's the way they looked at business. It was the wild, wild west. And by hook or crook, it was just win or lose, and the best win.
It's 1868, and America is rising out of the ashes of the Civil War. Railroads have united the states, and commerce flows with a speed never before thought possible. The man at the forefront of this explosive change is railroad tycoon Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt. But at 76, he realizes that the railroads have been overbuilt, and the future of the industry isn't in building new lines, but in transporting new cargo. To stay ahead of the competition, the Commodore turns to a new exploding industry. Oil is revolutionizing life in America. Crude from the ground is being refined into kerosene, a safe and inexpensive source of light. And that access to light is completely changing the way Americans live. Before kerosene, the average American didn't have access to a consistent light source. When the sun came down, darkness ruled. Kerosene is a phenomenon that will forever change the world, and Vanderbilt knows it's his next opportunity to cash in. If Vanderbilt can corner the market on those oil shipments, he'll propel himself back to the top of the railroad industry. All he needs to do now is find a supplier.
We're going to extend along the South Shore to Cleveland.
Why Cleveland?
Cleveland is a small city of just under 50,000. But it's sitting on top of an ocean of oil. Eastern Ohio is the Middle East of its day, and the area around Cleveland is one of the largest oil fields in the world. Vanderbilt learns about a refinery built near the railroads in Cleveland. He reaches out to the owner, a struggling young oil man Vanderbilt is hoping to pluck from obscurity. That oil man is John D. Rockefeller.
Why are we paying so much on plumbers?
We run a refinery.
So we start making our own pipes. At this rate, we'll be lucky if we break even this year.
If you want to call it a day, John, just say. I should go.
Is everything all right?
It's fine.
At the age of 27, Rockefeller is in the early stages of building his refining business. But his company is teetering on the verge of bankruptcy. Vanderbilt sees him as someone he can manipulate to his advantage. Vanderbilt invites Rockefeller to meet with him in New York. For the young oil man, the meeting is the opportunity of a lifetime, a way out of his troubles, and a way to save his company from complete collapse.
Rockefeller, he respected Vanderbilt. He could see what he had achieved. Vanderbilt was setting the pattern and the archetype of what Rockefeller himself wanted to be. He wanted to be the Vanderbilt of petroleum. That's the way he saw himself.
As Rockefeller prepares for his trip to New York, Vanderbilt's plan is set in motion. The train departs Cleveland at 6:25 a.m. Crossing a bridge.
The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want.
John Rockefeller narrowly missed the train.
He maketh me to lie down in green pastures.
One that would have carried him to his certain death.
He restoreth my soul.
The close call has a profound impact on the young oil man. A man of deep faith. He is convinced that God has spared him for a reason.
This is Our American Stories, and we come back more of this compelling life story, the life story of John D. Rockefeller. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and we continue with our This Day in History segment brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, and all the things that matter in life. And on this day in history, John D. Rockefeller was born. Let's continue with the story.
Here's historian H.W. Brands.
Without thinking that he himself, in particular, was chosen by God to become this great business success, Rockefeller believed that everything was divinely ordained. So nothing happened in the world without God's will, without God's blessing.
Rockefeller once again heads to meet with Vanderbilt as a changed man. Where before he was intimidated and facing bankruptcy, now he's a man of destiny. Cornelius Vanderbilt may be the richest and most powerful man in the country, accustomed to getting what he wants, but he has no idea what he's about to encounter.
play cards, Mr. Rockefeller?
No.
Shame. You could learn a lot about competition.
I know all I need to know.
So, I'm looking to do a deal with an oil refinery. And that could be you.
I'm willing to do an exclusive deal. $1.65 a barrel.
That's a discount of more than a third. There's several refineries in Cleveland. Why should I give you such a deal?
Because I'll fill all your trains with my oil. And if you don't do the deal, I'll fill someone else's trains.
Rockefeller may have gotten the rate he was looking for, but in return, he's agreed to provide Vanderbilt with over 60 train cars of oil every day. The only problem is Rockefeller has no way to produce that much kerosene.
Do you trust him?
I don't know.
His capacity is less than half of that. Rockefeller has overpromised, but he knows the deal with Vanderbilt will be the opportunity he's been waiting for. He just needs to find a way to produce more kerosene. It's a daunting task, but John D. Rockefeller has been beating the odds his entire life. Born the second among six children in 1839, Rockefeller is raised in a poor Cleveland household. Though external circumstances are dire, he is, and will remain throughout his life, a very devout Baptist, seeking refuge in his Christian faith in times of poverty and in times of plenty. As a young man, he shows a strong entrepreneurial streak, starting his own small business selling candy to local children.
Thank you very much.
From an early age, Rockefeller helps to support his family, mostly because he was never able to rely on his father.
It cures cancer. Folks, that is right, it cures cancer. Now you're asking yourself, sir, I bet in your mind you're saying, Bill, is this true?
Unlike his devout, disciplinarian Baptist mother Eliza, John's father, William Avery Rockefeller, is in the oil business. Snake oil, that is. He is a philandering con man in the 1830s and 40s, roaming upstate New York, selling bogus cancer cures.
Becca, I met 7 years ago, she had pneumonia.
Better known around Cleveland as Devil Bill.
Who would like to buy some? $1.25 a bottle. I'm only here for one day. Once I'm gone, I am gone. I may not be back.
Late at night, Devil Bill will sneak into the house and steal from John D's money jar and abandon the family for months at a time, leaving his family without money to support themselves.
Never trust anybody, son. Not even me.
With his father gone, Rockefeller is forced to quit school and get a job to support his mother and siblings. His work ethic and intuition will become the building blocks for the American dream. Here's historian Ron Chernow.
He was making money as fast as he could from the time he was a teenager and giving it away as fast as he could. He was a Baptist. He was tithing as a teenager.
Rockefeller realizes oil has the potential to change the world and make him rich in the process. But Rockefeller knows that drilling for oil is a gamble filled with uncertainty. And since he doesn't believe in luck, he starts looking for a way to make money from oil without the risk.
He had a mind for efficiency. And there was probably something in him that looked at the production process and saw how wasteful that was. In the first place, you drill wells and they turn up dry. And then you drill wells and they hit a gusher and half the oil would be lost. And that offended his sense of efficiency.
I think entrepreneurs and certain business people just look at life and look at things that are changing
and are able to see those things and say, I can create a business out of that.
Rockefeller knows there's a better way. Refining oil turns crude from the ground into kerosene, a clean-burning fuel that can be used in lamps.
Once the oil gets to 350 degrees, the kerosene starts to vaporize. Then once it's cooled, you have a stable, pure product. How much to produce a gallon? 50, 60 cents, I don't know.
Rockefeller's insight puts him one step ahead of his competitors. He believes that while gamblers drill for oil, businessmen refine it.
Whoever could control the refining process could very well have the whole industry.
At 24 years old, Rockefeller invests everything he has, about $4,000, into building his first refinery. But he struggles early on to find an edge in the industry. That changes when the most powerful man in the country comes calling.
Mr. Rockefeller?
The deal with Vanderbilt gives him cheap shipping rates and the chance to corner the U.S. oil market. But he's overpromised, agreeing to supply 60 barrels a day when his capacity is less than half that. And when you've made a deal with the most powerful man in America, failure is not an option.
You have to be smart, you have to have vision, you have to have all of these different things. But the most successful people are the people that had the right idea but never, ever quit or gave up. The people that really succeed in life are those that don't quit.
Rockefeller needs to quickly expand his company. And to do that, he needs investors. The problem is, due to high demand, many refiners are rushing to market with dangerous kerosene. That's extremely volatile. Rockefeller sees the problem as an opportunity. He realizes that there's a need to calm the public's fears and provide them with a product that they can rely on. Rockefeller pitches his idea.
Oil refining, warehouses, barrel making, and shipping facilities.
Why the name?
Because Standard Oil will be the only company in the industry to guarantee a uniform quality of kerosene.
Rockefeller's Standard Oil quiets fears and immediately becomes the most sought-after product in the country, bringing in investor after investor. Here's Bert Folsom, professor of history at Hillsdale College.
We must ever remember, Rockefeller wrote to one of his partners in 1885, we are refining oil for the poor man. And he must have it cheap and good.
And when we come back, more on the life story of John D. Rockefeller. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories. And as always, our This Day in History segments are brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, and all the things that matter in life. And this is one of those stories that we periodically like to dive into, and we like to call them business stories, business history. And so often as we study history, it's relegated to one thing, it's political events, or at the extreme, sometimes it's military events. But here in Our American Stories, history includes the arts, it includes sports, it includes all aspects of American life, even comedians. Listen to our treatment of George Carlin's life and Johnny Carson's. And on the music front, Frank Sinatra's. What a remarkable life, what a remarkable American life. Straight up to Irving Berlin, Billy Joel, and even Robert Plant, not an American, but my goodness, the impact American music had on his life made us in the end treat him as an honorary American, and we chronicle his life story as well. And now back to the life story of John D. Rockefeller, born on this day in history.
Rockefeller quickly outgrows his deal with Vanderbilt. Once unable to fill Vanderbilt's trains, now he has more oil than the Commodore can possibly ship. And Vanderbilt's biggest competitor knows it. Tom Scott is the president of one of the largest train lines in the country. He wants to take Vanderbilt's place as king of the railroads, and he knows a deal with Rockefeller is the key. Scott heads to Cleveland with his protege, a young up-and-comer named Andrew Carnegie. As Scott's most trusted lieutenant, Carnegie has helped craft the pitch.
What I'm proposing is an alliance between...
You want a cartel between oil and railroads.
I prefer to call it by...
Give me the numbers.
Standard Oil will receive a 40% rebate for every barrel it ships.
We'll send papers over in the morning.
No. A verbal contract is fine.
Rockefeller gets a better deal from Scott than he ever could have gotten from Vanderbilt.
The shyster.
The Commodore has lost his competitive edge.
To the great frustration of Vanderbilt, Rockefeller very skillfully played those railroads against each other. Oil was something Rockefeller couldn't afford to let go. And so they fought very hard to get that traffic.
With the railroads in his pocket, Rockefeller can supply every home in the nation with Standard Oil kerosene. And with all that profit, Rockefeller begins to buy out his competitors.
And we need to stand together. I'm offering all of you a way out. So you can hold your heads high. The opportunity to sell to Standard Oil will be a godsend to you all. If you take Standard Oil stock, you and your loved ones will never know want.
His intent is simple. He wants to own every refinery in the country. It's a concept that's been impossible to execute. Today, we know it as a monopoly. By the 1880s, Rockefeller controls 90% of the North American oil supply. At 33, the Ohio oil man is now the most powerful man in the country. Vanderbilt realizes that the only way to combat Rockefeller is for the railroads to start working together. He forms an unlikely alliance with his biggest rival, Tom Scott, and together they agree to pull all of Rockefeller's deals. To Rockefeller, the move is nothing short of a declaration of war. Rockefeller is determined to find another way to transport his oil. Rockefeller's solution again comes from the most unlikely of places.
So we can increase the yield of the kerosene, but then we get more of the volatile waste. We can burn some of it off as fuel in the refinery, but its high flammability creates...
While visiting his oil refinery and observing the intricate pipe system, Rockefeller lands an idea that will be a game changer. Oil in the refinery is moved using large pipes, and Rockefeller realizes if those pipes can transport oil over short distances, they could also be used over longer distances. If Rockefeller can build a pipeline large enough, he'll be able to cut the railroads out of the oil business for good. The pipeline will require a massive investment and incredible risk. Here's Mark Cuban.
It probably comes early in an entrepreneur's life where you realize you're willing to do things in the business world that other people aren't willing to do. Everybody has got ideas and everybody's got ambitions, but most people aren't willing to cross that line. And I think an entrepreneur that's successful, that's your nature. Wherever there's change, wherever there's uncertainty, there's opportunity.
Rockefeller's workers labor around the clock, blasting through the countryside and laying over a mile and a half of pipeline every day. By the time the pipeline is complete, it's over 4,000 miles long, stretching across Ohio and Pennsylvania and connecting thousands of the world's most lucrative oil wells directly to Rockefeller's refineries. John Rockefeller has finally found his way to eliminate the railroads, the backbone of the American economy, from the oil business. And in the process, he's forever revolutionized the way oil is transported. It is a colossal blow to the railroad industry. Rockefeller's oil makes up 40% of the cargo shipped on the rails. Stocks plummet as investors run scared.
In the 1870s, the country needed to be connected via railroads. And what happens then is everybody who thinks they have an edge in the railroad business goes out and raises money and they start their own railroad. And what happened then, as we've seen happen many a time since then, is it created a huge bubble.
By the time the panic is through, one-third of the country's 360 railroad companies have gone bankrupt. The crash is the worst America has seen in its short history. Unsure how to prevent a complete collapse, the stock exchange shuts down and stays closed for 10 straight days. As his competition collapses, Rockefeller picks them off, buying out bankrupt oil companies for next to nothing.
I find that I do better in bad markets. I buy things in bad markets. And you can't do that in a great economy. You can't buy it. Either you're going to buy it very expensively or not be able to buy it at all. So there's a lot of opportunity, I find, in the bad times.
By the time the Depression is through, Rockefeller has created the largest corporate empire in America.
He was playing the game of industry, and he was simply better at it than everybody else.
The railroads were beaten, but when electrical lighting hit the market, Rockefeller quickly found out that great ideas would always provide more than enough competition for the free market. To keep Standard Oil profitable, Rockefeller needs to find a product to replace kerosene, and the answer may have been in front of him the entire time. Rockefeller targets a byproduct of oil refining that for years has been thrown away. The highly flammable toxic substance is called gasoline, and so far, no one has figured a use for it.
And when we come back, the final installment of this compelling story, the story you probably weren't taught in school, and that's why you listen, and that's why we do what we do here on Our American Stories, tell you the stories about people you should know that you probably don't. More after these messages. With Our American Stories, and now the final installment of our This Day in History segment, And on this day in history, John D. Rockefeller was born. Let's listen to the final installment of this hour.
Here's Professor Bert Folsom.
He believed there was a God-given use for every particle in a barrel of oil.
At just over 100 degrees, you get a mixture of alkanes.
And he was determined to find it.
Sadly, it can't be used for anything.
Rockefeller's staff found uses for the remaining components.
Why not?
Too volatile.
The gasoline is fuel. Some of the tar is for paving. And other byproducts to manufacture paint, varnish, and even anesthetics.
At this same time, the quest to create a more powerful motor leads to the invention of the internal combustion engine. The exact properties that make gasoline so dangerous also make it the perfect fuel to power this engine. The efficiency and power of the engine quickly make it the standard in factories across the country. But when the engine is put on wheels, creating what is being called the horseless carriage, Rockefeller realizes that gasoline is bigger than kerosene. Standard Oil is unstoppable. But as the 20th century rolls out, Rockefeller is about to come face to face with his biggest challenge ever. Shortly after the assassination of President McKinley in 1901, the 42-year-old Vice President Theodore Roosevelt,
and thus I swear,
is sworn in as President of the United States.
Now, let's get started.
And begins a crusade, filing federal antitrust lawsuits. J.P. Morgan is the first to lose, and his railroad monopoly is broken up. Roosevelt is elected to a second term, and over the course of his administration, he files suit against dozens of trusts. In 1911, the U.S. government files suit against Standard Oil in what promises to be the biggest antitrust case of all time. And their lead witness is John D. Rockefeller himself.
United States versus Standard Oil. This hearing is now in session. Please state your name.
John Rockefeller.
Mr. Rockefeller, the picture painted of Standard Oil is a depressing one. No trust in the history of America has been so destructive in its pursuit of profit. Time and time again, we have heard how Standard Oil has used secret kickbacks from the railroads, been routinely engaged in predatory pricing, used intimidation and exclusive sales territories to put refineries out of business. For over 30 years, Standard Oil has been on a mission to crush its competition and establish itself as a monopoly to hoist up the price of kerosene. Mr. Rockefeller, before the court renders its decision, do you have anything you wish to say?
The biggest antitrust trial of all time is about to reach a verdict. John D. Rockefeller offers the courtroom some context.
When I came into the oil industry, there was chaos. I brought order. I took a second-rate, inefficient market and built an industry. It was done the way it was because that's the way it had to be done. No one complained when I brought light into every home. No one complained when I provided thousands of jobs or millions of dollars from exports. Oil is what this country runs on. You call it monopoly. I call it enterprise. Now, you tell me, why am I here?
John Rockefeller has done all he can to keep his monopoly intact, but the fate of Standard Oil is out of his control.
In the case of the United States against the Standard Oil Company, this hearing has reached a decision. This court determines against the Standard Oil Trust on account of its unreasonable business practices, which are in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. The Standard Oil Trust must be broken up within 6 months.
John Rockefeller's Standard Oil is completely dismantled, broken up into 34 smaller companies that will ironically go on to be corporate giants. Here's historian Ron Chernow.
To give you some idea of the size of that trust, when it was dismantled in 1911, the heirs include what are today Exxon, Mobil, Amoco, Chevron, Conoco, ARCO, BP America, Cheeseborough Ponds, and two dozen other companies.
And John Rockefeller is a shareholder in each one of those companies. Even in defeat, John Rockefeller becomes the richest man in the history of the world, with a net worth of over $660 billion in today's money. He is the world's first billionaire. Today's new breed of businessmen may be doing things differently from their predecessors, but their innovations wouldn't be possible without the groundwork laid by men like John D. Rockefeller. The result is broad prosperity shared across the country and throughout the world, and perhaps America's greatest invention yet, a thriving and prosperous middle class. Here's Charles Schwab.
The Industrial Revolution created the development of the middle class. It created wealth that we never would have imagined possible before.
John Rockefeller will live to give away more than $540 million in his lifetime. Gifts that today would total over $10 billion. Rockefeller had always equated charity and philanthropy with his Christian values, writes Phil Anschutz. He often said, God gave me money, and he intended to use his good fortune to advance God's work on earth. He also created the University of Chicago. He supported Baptist conventions, missionaries, and relief efforts. He underwrote colleges for blacks, including the Tuskegee Institute, Morehouse College, and Spelman College to educate freed female slaves. Spelman College is named after his pious and ardently abolitionist wife, Laura Spelman, whose family had been conductors on the Underground Railroad. And never did Rockefeller ever publicize any of his philanthropic works. He found the notion distasteful. On the other hand, Rockefeller saw no place for showering his children with his wealth.
One of the most interesting details that I discovered during the research was that John D. Rockefeller Jr., who was the only son, the youngest of four children, said that until the age of eight, he wore only female clothes. We all wore hand-me-downs, and the three older siblings were all girls. And so the hand-me-downs that were coming down to me were all, you know, dresses and skirts. This is how frugally they were brought up. So that John D. tried to recreate his own threadbare childhood with the children, even though he was en route to becoming the richest man in the world, because he wanted them to learn the value of dollar. You know, and he was determined that these children were going to be thrifty and responsible. And to a remarkable extent, he succeeded, because you see a lot of famous families burn out after a generation or two. The Rockefellers have managed to go on being a significant force in business, politics, and philanthropy in this country.
John D. Rockefeller died on May 23rd, 1937. And as the nation headed deeper into the 20th century, millions of Americans, for the first time ever, were able to take part in the American dream, employed in well-paid and safe jobs, manufacturing products they themselves could now afford. The country is united with a robust economy that benefits not just the rich, but everyone. It's the beginning of one of the longest periods of prosperity America will ever see. Here's Carly Fiorina.
America was transformed by the vision, the incredible hard work and determination, and the willingness to take big risks that these men displayed. There is also no question that these men could not have done what they did anywhere else but America, because this place allows more people to dream than any other place in the world. All that matters is how big do you want to dream and how hard do you want to work.
From a broken country into the most powerful nation on earth, America was not discovered. Guys like John D. Rockefeller built it.
And there you have it, a story you probably didn't know. And my goodness, what a stemwinder. As always, our This Day in History segments brought to us by Hillsdale College. This is Lee Habib. If you want to hear our This Day in History segments, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org, click the This Day in History icon, and there's nearly 100 of them there for you to listen while you're driving, cooking, whatever. Again, this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories.